and Columbia before spending more than 30 years practicing law in New York, lately with Paul Hastings, a White Shoe U.S. law firm. He was fast-talking and likable, known for working all hours and developing personal relationships with clients. Over the years, he had built up contacts in the Middle East via multiple business deals. Edelman became an advisor to Mubadala, and Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince Mohammed often sought his advice on cross-border real estate deals. He even weighed in sometimes on affairs of state. Executives at Mubadala had introduced Lowe to Edelman, and the lawyer set up a meeting with Witkoff. Yet again, Lowe had leveraged his powerful connections, and Witkoff saw him as the real deal. That he seemed to have bottomless financing didn't hurt. Lowe agreed to fund 85% of the deal, with Witkoff's investor group taking a 15% stake. In response to an emailed request for details about his funding from a Witkoff executive, Lowe responded, "Lowe family capital built from our grandparents, down to the third generation now." Another Witkoff executive told Wells Fargo, which was lending money for the project, that Lowe's capital derives from a family trust. In the months ahead, the Witkoff group discussed how to develop the Park Lane. Due to New York's zoning laws, part of the original hotel needed to be incorporated into the new structure. The investors hired Herzog & de Meuron, the Swiss architects, who envisaged an almost 1,000-foot tower with an undulating facade and a raised podium. The architect's sketches showed the sleek building, set for completion in 2020, towering over its neighbors on Central Park South. Lowe was excited. He suggested putting outdoor swimming pools on the exterior decks of the 5 penthouses, which the partners hoped would sell for more than $100 million apiece. The deal for the Park Lane closed in November 2013, and Lowe paid his initial $200 million investment with money taken from the latest Goldman bond and sent on a dizzying journey through shell companies, bank accounts of family members, and U.S. law firm trust accounts. Lowe was on his way to developing a high-profile property that could make his name. At the same time, he was playing another angle. Until now, he'd seen corporate deals as a way to add credibility to his family wealth story. But perhaps he'd been looking at it from the wrong angle. Instead of an endpoint for stolen cash, maybe he could use corporate acquisitions as a way of moving money elsewhere. Once he bought a major asset and then sold it, the money would be gold-plated, the respectable earnings from a deal. The Park Lane offered him a way of moving hundreds of millions of dollars in one fell swoop. In December, Lowe agreed to sell a minority interest in the project to Mubadala for $135 million. Most of the proceeds from this sale ended up in the private accounts of Lowe, his brother Zen, and his father Larry at BSI in Singapore. Here were the proceeds from the sale of a stake in one of New York's most ambitious real estate developments, hopefully rubbing out all traces of links to the $3 billion Goldman bond. Lowe still needed to reward Ambassador Oteba for the latest deal involving Abu Dhabi. This was the least the ambassador expected for making all these connections for Lowe. In a meeting in December with Awatani, Oteba's business partner, Lowe promised to send the pair money by the end of the year. Then he set about laundering the proceeds of his stake sale to Mubadala through yet another corporate acquisition. And Goldman, of course, would be involved. Lowe had been deepening his connections at Goldman and had gotten to know Hazem Shaki, the bank's Dubai-based head of investment banking, who heard pitches from the Malaysian. One of them involved a plan for Lowe to take over Coastal Energy, a Houston firm controlled by legendary Texas oilman Oscar Wyatt Jr. Lowe, informally advised by Goldman, approached Coastal in 2012 about a takeover, but the firm didn't believe he could come up with cash and told him to find a bigger partner. Now armed with cash from the Park Lane sale, Lowe returned with none other than IPIC, the Abu Dhabi fund controlled by Kadem Al-Kubaisi, who had helped funnel money out from the first 1MDB bonds sold by Goldman. IPIC's Spanish energy unit, Compañía Española de Petróleos, SAU or CEPSA, agreed to partner with a low-controlled shell company to make a $2.2 billion offer for Coastal. Before an agreement with the U.S. energy company could be reached, Goldman's compliance department told its bankers to stop working with Lowe or his entity on the deal, again citing concerns over his wealth. It was the same reason Goldman's private bank had given to reject Lowe for an account a few years earlier. As a result, Goldman switched to advising CEPSA, the IPIC unit, even though its bankers were aware that Lowe was still involved. Eventually, Wyatt Jr. agreed to sell, and Lowe invested $50 million in the deal, with CEPSA funding the remainder of the purchase price. 1 week later, CEPSA transferred $350 million into Lowe's shell company, ostensibly to buy out Lowe's share in the partnership. He had made 600% on his money in a matter of days. Shawkey, the Goldman banker, who was now working with IPIC, told executives at the Abu Dhabi fund that the payout to Lowe was to reward him for scouting out the Coastal deal. Unknown to Shawkey, in reality, it was nothing less than corruption. The spoils shared between Lowe and Al-Kubaisi. In public, Goldman denied knowledge of any agreement between CEPSA and Lowe's shell company. The Malaysian used some of the proceeds to buy an office in London's Mayfair district, which became the headquarters of Myla, his lingerie brand. If anyone inquired, Lowe could say the money came from a sale of his stake in Coastal Energy, which he acquired after offloading a share in New York's Park Lane Hotel. His plans to build a corporate empire were on track. No one, from major New York real estate developers to bankers and lawyers, knew the truth about him. Lowe and Al-Kubaisi continued to act as if the money in the firms they oversaw was their private property. But as Lowe closed the Park Lane deal, an unexpected development risked bringing his scheme to an abrupt end. Chapter 34. 140 Gigabytes. Bangkok, Thailand, October 2013. Since leaving PetroSaudi in 2011, Xavier Justo had tried to put the server out of his mind. He toured Southeast Asia with his girlfriend Laura, a Swiss-French woman whom he later married on a secluded beach, and the pair were now developing a luxurious villa on the Thai resort island of Koh Samui, a short flight from Bangkok. The spacious main house and guest villas were nestled into a terraced hillside, with a lap pool and tennis court down below. Palm trees surrounded the property. It was Justo's dream island, a place to start a new life. But plans for a financial consulting business had failed to bear fruit. As the villa's construction costs mounted, Justo remembered the money PetroSaudi promised but never paid. He played his card. For over 2 years, Justo had nursed his grievances. The former PetroSaudi employee was bitter over how his former friend, Tarek Obaid, had thrown him out of the company without the payout he desired. What's more, Justo had heard from friends that Obaid was bad-mouthing him around their hometown of Geneva. In the fall of 2013, Justo had contacted Patrick Mahoney, PetroSaudi's director of investments, by email, informing him that he had damaging information. In fact, he had a copy of PetroSaudi's computer server. A 140-gigabyte treasure trove of almost 500,000 emails and documents from PetroSaudi, the server's contents painted a picture of how Lowe, Mahoney, and Obaid had worked to take money from 1MDB, including emails in which the PetroSaudi principals talked about how to cover the hole. For 2 years, Justo had sat on the server, fearing the consequences of making its contents public. Now, he was losing his patience and set up a meeting with Mahoney in Bangkok to negotiate. As he sat in Bangkok's Shangri-La Hotel, waiting for Mahoney to turn up, Justo knew he was about to make a very dangerous move. The hotel, set on the banks of the churning Chao Phraya River, had a resort-like feel, with palm trees and a laguna-style swimming pool, offering respite from the bustle of the chaotic Thai capital. When Mahoney finally appeared, Justo's heart jumped. Justo began by recounting how he felt duped by PetroSaudi, which had agreed to pay him millions of Swiss francs in severance, but then had scaled back the amount dramatically. Now he wanted 2.5 million Swiss francs, money he believed was due to him. Mahoney was cool to Giusto's demands. There was no evidence to suggest wrongdoing, he said. Petro Saudi would absolutely not pay him any cash. They parted without an agreement. Giusto barraged Mahoney with emails, trying to get him to agree to the payment. The official side paints a nice picture, but the reality is commissions, 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 he wrote in one email. For 4 years now, Mahoney had avoided any blowback on the deal, perhaps believing the involvement of Prime Minister Najib and a Saudi prince protected him. He must have been rattled by developments, but still felt untouchable. In one email, he issued a dark threat to his former friend and colleague. What troubles me so much is the way I see this situation ending, with the destruction of you. Rather than cow Giusto, the dark threat emboldened him to look for a suitable buyer for his data trove. No candidate immediately sprang to mind. As he thought over what to do, a former British journalist with ties to Malaysia was just getting interested in Joe Low. Soon, their paths would cross. In December 2013, Claire Rucastle Brown sat at the dining room table in her fourth-floor central London apartment, tapping away on a MacBook Pro. She was preparing a piece for her blog, Sarawak Report. Born in the Malaysian state of Sarawak in 1959 to a young British police officer and nurse, Rucastle Brown spent her childhood years playing in the jungle and swimming in the warm sea, sometimes tagging along as her mother visited villages to work as a midwife. After returning to the United Kingdom for boarding school in the late 1960s, Rucastle Brown eventually got a job as a reporter with the BBC World Service. But she had never forgotten Sarawak. She'd started Sarawak Report in 2010 as an attempt to hold Tabe Mahmood, Sarawak's chief minister, to account for the environmental destruction and corruption in his state. Now 54 years old, with long brown hair and bangs, Rucastle Brown was married to the brother of former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Though connected to Britain's establishment, Rucastle Brown believed strongly that politicians must answer for their actions. When Tabe claimed Sarawak Report was part of a plot to recolonize the state, she reveled in taunting the powerful figure on her blog, with little fear about making enemies in high places. But this latest story was not about Sarawak. Weeks earlier, Rucastle Brown had started to hear rumors from sources in Malaysia about Red Granite, the film company run by Najib's stepson, Riza Aziz. Few among Malaysia's elite bought into Riza's claims of Middle Eastern funding. And Rucastle Brown picked up on gossip in Kuala Lumpur that Malaysian state-owned entities might have financed the film company. Intrigued, she traveled to Los Angeles to gather more information about Red Granite. During her reporting, she came across a lawsuit filed in Los Angeles over the summer by the producers of Dumb and Dumber, the 1994 comedy starring Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels. Red Granite had bought the rights to a sequel, Dumb and Dumber 2, but it had shut out the producers of the original film. In July 2013, Red Granite filed a lawsuit seeking to exclude the producers, Steve Stabler and Brad Crevoy, from involvement in the movie. Stabler and Crevoy countersued, claiming a contractual right to involvement in any sequel. Red Granite had only just settled with Alexandra Milchin, a producer who had sued after the firm booted her from The Wolf of Wall Street. And now it was involved in another legal tussle. McFarland and Aziz's misconduct and hubris will cause Red Granite to crash and burn, Stabler and Crevoy claimed in their lawsuit. The pair lacked experience to successfully produce motion pictures themselves, the suit continued. And although Red Granite apparently had family money from Aziz, the venture would not succeed with cash alone. Then the producers hit home, summarizing what many in Hollywood were whispering about these upstarts behind their backs. The Red Granite executives' experience producing motion pictures during their short tenure in the industry consists of cavorting at nightclubs with Paris Hilton and making dinner reservations at posh restaurants in New York and Los Angeles. The following year, both sides withdrew their suits after an agreement that included executive producer credits on the film for Stabler and Cravoy. To Rue Castle Brown, something wasn't right. It seemed greater than a squabble between a bunch of movie producers. She began to comb through interviews that Risa and Joey McFarland had given to The Hollywood Reporter and Los Angeles Times. As Red Granite had attracted notice at the Cannes Film Festival in 2011, and now ahead of the U.S. theatrical release of The Wolf of Wall Street on Christmas Day 2013, the pair had been coy about their finances. They talked vaguely about money from the Middle East and Asia, but declined to give more specifics. In one interview, Risa said how he had skin in the game. This made no sense to Rue Castle Brown. How could a former junior banker, with Najib as a stepfather, have enough capital to launch a film company? It was a mystery she wanted to solve. Chapter 35. Leo's Wall Street Indictment. New York, December 2013. On December 17th, a windy, sub-zero winter's night with a flurry of snow, the guests milled around outside the Ziegfeld Theater on 54th Street in Midtown Manhattan for the premiere of The Wolf of Wall Street. On the red carpet, McFarland and Aziz posed with DiCaprio, Margot Robbie, and Jonah Hill. McFarland was in his element, boasting about his gray Brioni suit on his Instagram account. Wearing a dark blue suit and maroon tie, Lowe couldn't help but attend, despite his earlier efforts to keep out of the limelight. He had to be there to celebrate this extraordinary achievement. In just a few short years, Lowe had gone from being a low-tier Malaysian financier to effectively bankrolling one of the splashiest Hollywood films of the year, and one about a fraudster. Just as Belfort, for a time, had enjoyed the fruits of his scheme, Lowe couldn't miss out on this evening. He wanted to share his success with those closest to him, and the business partners he yearned to impress. Lowe's guest list included family members, his girlfriend, Jessalyn Chuan Teek Ying, seated next to his mother, Jasmine Liu of 1MDB, Swizz Beatz, Kadem Al-Kubaisi of iPic, Steve Witkoff, and Martin Edelman. Lowe posed with the Red Granite founders on the red carpet, but he didn't take part in the photos with the main cast. He was snapped with DiCaprio, though, milling around before the performance. The pair had remained close. A month earlier, Lowe had attended the star's 39th birthday party in Tao downtown in New York's Chelsea district. That night, McFarland had made page 6 of the New York Post for ordering bottle after bottle of champagne. Lowe's parties, and DiCaprio's attendance at them, were by now embedded in Hollywood lore, even getting a mention in a song on the soundtrack for the film 22 Jump Street. The party anthem, Check My Steezo, featured the lyrics, Joe Lowe, I see you, Joe Lowe. Got Leo at my party taking shots never solo. Grade A chorizo followed by sea bass, miso miso, miso loco. The Red Granite principals and Lowe had assiduously cultivated DiCaprio, whom they hoped would star in Papillon, or if not that, then another one of their upcoming movies. A few weeks after The Wolf of Wall Street premiere, Lowe, posing as Eric Tan, sent DiCaprio a $3.3 million painting by Pablo Picasso as a late birthday present. The oil painting, Nature Morte au Cran de Taureau, was accompanied with a handwritten note. Dear Leonardo DiCaprio, happy belated birthday. This gift is for you, it read. Then, Lowe told a Swiss gallery that was storing a $9.2 million Basquiat, a collage entitled Red Man One, to transfer ownership to DiCaprio. The order, made in a letter also signed by DiCaprio, indemnified the actor from any liability whatsoever resulting directly or indirectly from these artwork. The actor also got a photograph by Diane Arbus, cost $750,000, from Lowe. In private, DiCaprio was happy to accept these gifts. On the red carpet, he was in a more philosophical mood. Some critics of the film, including voting members of the Academy who heckled Scorsese at an official screening ahead of the Oscars, complained it glamorized Jordan Belfort's fraud and was more likely to spawn financial malfeasance than serve as a cautionary tale. DiCaprio had carefully prepared his retort. "This is an indictment of all of Wall Street, but it's an indictment about something that's in our culture. This incessant need to consume, and this incessant need to obtain more and more wealth with complete disregard for anyone except yourself," he told one interviewer. 2 days after the premiere of The Wolf of Wall Street, Rucastle Brown let rip in a post titled, "Wall Street Greed, Malaysian Money, Exposé." It was typical Rucastle Brown, a mix of speculation and reporting, spiced up with acerbic asides and tabloid-esque headlines. The piece boiled down to asking one enormous question. Who had paid for the film? Skilled at rounding up interviews and photos available on the web, pointing out inconsistencies, Rucastle Brown noted how Risa and McFarland had suspiciously refused to detail Red Granite's financing. Her piece linked to a story on a U.S. real estate website about Risa's $33.5 million purchase of the Park Laurel apartment. Where was the money coming from? Perhaps Joe Lowe, whom Rucastle Brown described as a close friend of Rosma and Risa, could have put up the money himself, she speculated. The little-known Malaysian financier was on the red carpet for the premiere and seemed to be close to DiCaprio, attending his recent birthday event at Tao Downtown. Rucastle Brown's piece, peppered with photos of Lowe, alongside Paris Hilton in Saint-Tropez, holding champagne in a nightclub, at the Wolf of Wall Street premiere, was the most intense scrutiny yet of his activities. She had a sizable following in Malaysia, and was edging toward the truth. The post ended with an acute observation. Many may wonder if the link to the top political players in Malaysia and friendship with the PM's stepson might account for Joe Lowe's easy access to investment income, or indeed if he is the front man for others. This was too much for Red Granite, whose lawyers quickly fired off a letter demanding retraction and an apology, which Rucastle Brown ignored. There was no Malaysian money in the film, the letter said. Talents of the caliber of Scorsese and DiCaprio, it went on, never would have gotten involved if the financing was tainted. Chapter 36. The Oval Office. New York, December 2013. Leonardo DiCaprio ducked into the Four Seasons restaurant on 52nd Street in Midtown Manhattan and made his way to a private room. Since the late 1950s, the restaurant had catered to the city's business elite, to the point that, in the 1970s, Esquire magazine coined the term power lunch to refer to the meetings held between lawyers, bankers, and ad executives over steaks in the grill room, with its leather sofas and wood-paneled walls. Jordan Belfort, too, dined there, and DiCaprio and Margot Robbie, who played Belfort's second wife, filmed a scene for The Wolf of Wall Street in the pool room, dining under the indoor trees near the water feature. The night before, after the film's premiere at the Ziegfeld, DiCaprio had moved on to the after-party at the Roseland Ballroom, a converted ice rink, also on 52nd Street, with his wolf pack in tow, friends like Orlando Bloom and Tobey Maguire. DiCaprio's schedule was packed, and the next morning he was at the Four Seasons to meet members of the Academy, the 6,000-member body of former actors, directors, and other movie professionals who vote on the year's Oscar winners. He was running late to catch a plane and didn't really have time for the lunch event put on by Paramount Pictures, the film's distributor. Scorsese was already en route to the airport and wouldn't make the lunch. But DiCaprio's presence was crucial, and he made his way around the room, greeting Academy members. The glad-handing was important public relations. The Academy was dominated by old, white males, and several of them had shown hostility to the film, with its gleeful depiction of sex and drugs. After 10 minutes, DiCaprio made his excuses and exited quietly, befuddling some in the room, leaving Margot Robbie to animate the event with jokes about the awkward sex scenes between her and DiCaprio. After years in the business, DiCaprio had gotten used to the usual flurry of events that follow a major film release. But the next meeting on his schedule was more enticing. Outside the Four Seasons, a car was waiting to take the actor to the airport, where he would fly on to Washington, D.C. There, he would deliver a DVD of the film to President Barack Obama. As usual, Washington was a few degrees warmer than New York, and there was no snow, but DiCaprio was wrapped in a dark coat and cap as he went through White House security. Accompanying him was a small group that included Scorsese, Riza Aziz, and Nur Rahman Najib, the son of Malaysia's prime minister. Escorting them to see the president was Frank White Jr., one of Obama's foremost individual fundraisers. With pronounced cheeks and an easy smile, White was an entrepreneur who made his fortune providing information technology support to the U.S. government, including the intelligence community. In the 2008 elections, he raised more than $10 million as a bundler, a supporter who collects small individual contributions and delivers them to a campaign. By 2012, White was national vice chair of the president's re-election campaign. Born and raised in Chicago, where he'd studied at the University of Illinois, he also had family ties to the White House. His sister was married to Michelle Obama's cousin and was a regular attendee of state dinners. He was also deeply entwined with Joe Low. During the 2008 campaign, White got to know Prakasral Samuel Michel, better known as Praz, a former member of the 1990s hip-hop band The Fugees, and Shamik Dutta, who had worked as an investment banker at Morgan Stanley. After The Fugees and a short-lived solo career, ghetto superstar, that is what you are, Praz was looking to reinvent himself as a businessman. A longtime fixture on the Hollywood party scene, he'd heard from a nightclub promoter about these showy events a young Malaysian was throwing, and by 2012 was a regular at Lowe's parties. Like DiCaprio and Scorsese, Praz saw Lowe's billions as a business opportunity, and the pair became close. He started to tell his new friend about Frank White, a political operative he'd met on the campaign trail, and Lowe was entranced. Lowe moved quickly, trying to figure out a way he could benefit from a connection to White. Could he leverage the new contact to acquire influence in the United States, as he had done with Oteiba in Abu Dhabi and Prince Turki in Saudi Arabia? On the face of it, Lowe's ambition seemed laughably lofty. But Malaysian connections were enticing to some in Washington at that moment. Since taking office, Obama had been keen to befriend Najib to deepen U.S. influence in Asia, part of the president's much-vaunted pivot to East Asia. Some in the White House and State Department, as well as retired diplomats, including old hands like John Mallett, a former U.S. ambassador to Kuala Lumpur, had urged caution about Najib, pointing out the prime minister was showing increasingly anti-democratic tendencies. In 2013, after losing the vote of ethnic Chinese and Indian Malaysians, the prime minister turned to solidify his Malay base. Despite initially pledging to repeal it, Najib and his government had used a colonial-era sedition law to prosecute opposition leaders, students, and critical academics. But the White House, especially Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, clung to its vision of Najib as a transformative prime minister, not least because of constant lobbying from Jamaluddin Jarris, a former Malaysian ambassador to Washington who was now special envoy to the United States. A senior UMNO politician and one of Najib's closest friends, Jamaluddin was an architect of efforts for closer U.S.-Malaysia ties, and he was agitating for Obama's staff to organize an official presidential visit to Malaysia. It was his daughter who interned at Goldman Sachs in Singapore and had an affair with Tim Leisner. To build his connection to the White House, Lowe got involved with efforts to re-elect Obama to a second four-year term. Praz Michel would be his conduit. In 2012, Lowe sent $20 million from an offshore company he controlled to two companies owned by Praz. The money was ostensibly a gift, but the musician used one of these firms to make a $1.2 million donation to a super PAC called Black Men Vote, which supported Obama's campaign. It was a risky move for Praz, as donating money to a candidate on behalf of another person is a violation of federal campaign finance laws. A lawyer for Praz later said the musician was the victim of a false narrative. Lowe also reached an agreement for Frank White to scout for projects and act as a cheerleader for Malaysia with the Obama administration. For that, White was paid handsomely. Lowe in 2012 arranged for $10 million in 1MDB money to move to White via MB Consulting, a firm controlled by Abar's Mohammed al-Husseini. In return, White went to work. In October 2012, he set up a meeting between Obama and the Red Granite crew. Joey McFarland posted a picture on Instagram of himself shaking hands with President Obama at White's home. When the president won re-election in November, Lowe wanted to celebrate with a visit to the White House. Later that month, White arranged for Lowe to attend the president's holiday party. Lowe later showed off a photograph of himself with Obama and the First Lady to friends. But on another occasion, White House security personnel turned Lowe away at the door. It seemed the U.S. government had growing reason to be wary of this young Malaysian with a mysterious past. Undeterred, Lowe doubled down on his investment in White, an association he hoped could influence White House policy. In May 2013, White set up DuSable Capital Management in Washington with Praz and Dutta, the banker who also had worked as a special assistant in the White House. Soon after, the fund told the Securities and Exchange Commission that it was planning to raise $500 million to invest in renewable energy and infrastructure projects. The plan was for Abar to put in the majority of the capital, with White investing a small amount himself. DuSable registered as a lobbyist for 1MDB, and by the end of the year, White was arranging for another White House tour, this time for DiCaprio's group. DiCaprio and Scorsese did in fact hand over a DVD copy of The Wolf of Wall Street to President Obama, but there was little publicity for the visit. The administration didn't want to be seen unduly influencing the upcoming Oscar race. The Wolf of Wall Street was viewed as an outside challenger to Dallas Buyers Club, 12 Years a Slave, and Gravity. The famous director and actor were spotted later in the day having tea at the W Hotel, just across 15th Street from the White House. But neither of them mentioned the meeting with Obama in the barrage of interviews that followed the film's public release a few days later, on Christmas Day. Between the release and the Oscars in early March, Lowe headed off on his traditional end-of-year ski trip with friends and family. This year's destination was Aspen, Colorado. Lowe's guests included Alicia Keys, Swizz Beatz, Joey McFarland, and his girlfriend Antoinette Costa. The town was awash with celebrities, and Leonardo DiCaprio, Tobey Maguire, Nicole Scherzinger, and her boyfriend, Formula One world champion Lewis Hamilton, attended some of Lowe's gatherings. At one dinner, the actor Dakota Johnson, the daughter of Melanie Griffith and Don Johnson, was sitting next to Lowe, who thought she was a random stranger. Now used to fraternizing with bigger stars, Lowe had no time for Johnson. "She ate food and didn't even say thank you afterward," Lowe complained to friends. At one point, Lowe bumped into Paris Hilton, who also was in Aspen. He had remained friendly with Hilton, even though he saw her less now than back in 2010. The pair went to get pizza. The chat that week, at the St. Regis Aspen Resort, centered on The Wolf of Wall Street and whether DiCaprio would finally win an Oscar. As he snowboarded, Lowe had good reason to be content. The film would be extremely lucrative at the box office, earning more than $400 million globally, almost four times the cost of production. Despite his constant scheming, Lowe was exhibiting skill as an investor. Viceroy Hotel Group, in which he now owned a half share, had expanded, gaining a name as a five-star boutique chain. His 13% stake in EMI Music Publishing also was a winner, as the global music business recovered due to digital sales via streaming services. The Wolf of Wall Street was his most successful investment to date, and Red Granite had a promising pipeline of new films in development. If the company became one of the biggest producers in Hollywood, Lowe wagered, there would be oodles of cash to put back into 1MDB. As the award season came around, The Wolf of Wall Street was expected to do well. In January, DiCaprio won a Golden Globe for his role as Jordan Belfort, using his acceptance speech to thank Joey, Riz, and Joe for taking a risk on the project. Joe Lowe was also thanked in the film's closing credits. But the big prize remained just out of DiCaprio's grasp yet again. At the Oscars, in early March, the Best Actor statuette was handed to Matthew McConaughey for Dallas Buyers Club. It was a terrible night for The Wolf of Wall Street, which, despite 5 nominations, failed to pick up any awards. For Lowe and Riza, sitting behind Bono and The Edge from U2 in the Dolby Theater, the evening fell a little flat. To top off their Oscar buzzkill, the movie wasn't even going to play back home in Malaysia. To comply with local morality laws, Malaysian authorities demanded more than 90 cuts, and Paramount Pictures, the film's distributor, together with Scorsese and Red Granite, had decided it wasn't worth the trouble. But no matter. An even bigger American import was soon set to land in Malaysia. On April 27, 2014, Obama became the first U.S. president to visit Malaysia in 5 decades. The iconic image of the visit was a selfie that Najib took of himself and Obama. The president leaned in, beaming broadly, while Najib didn't quite know where to look as the camera snapped. "My selfie with President Obama," the prime minister tweeted moments later. The world had gone selfie mad months earlier when Ellen DeGeneres had taken one at the Oscars with Bradley Cooper, Meryl Streep, Brad Pitt, and other stars. It was Najib's moment to shine on a world stage. The leaders had spent the morning at the National Mosque, where Najib's father was buried, and the prime minister used the visit to underline his special relationship with Obama. For years, U.S. presidents had avoided Malaysia, put off by former Prime Minister Mahathir's strident anti-Western rhetoric, and the nation's authoritarian bent. Now, Obama was finally in Malaysia as part of a tour that also included close allies like Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. His deputy national security advisor, Ben Rhodes, who was also on the trip, called Malaysia a pivotal state in the region, a code for a bulwark against China. In recent months, Beijing had been taking a militarist approach toward enforcing its territorial claims to the entire South China Sea. President Obama, keen to balance this aggression, promised in a joint statement with Najib to help train and equip Malaysia's navy. The statement also stressed the two leaders' support for a vibrant civil society. For some State Department officials who had counseled against the visit, given Najib's government was busy locking up opposition politicians, this last pledge was derisory. As Obama toured Malaysia, Lowe bragged to contacts that he had played a role in the rapprochement with the United States. Just days before Obama arrived, 1MDB signed a multi-million dollar deal with Frank White's company, DuSable Capital, to develop a solar electricity plant in Malaysia. The 1MDB fund's management falsely described the deal to the board as a government-to-government endeavor, even though DuSable was a private entity. Lowe was hoping Obama and Najib would highlight the joint venture plan during the president's visit, but he was learning it wasn't as easy to stage manage events with the United States as in the Middle East. For one, he didn't have an ambassador-level figure like Oteiba at his disposal, only Frank White, who, although close to Obama, was a mere businessman and fundraiser. Only months later, the solar deal was scrapped, and 1MDB eventually paid $69 million to buy out DuSable's share in the joint venture. White had plucked a fortune from thin air. He'd later say the deal was intended to provide renewable energy in Malaysia, create jobs in the United States, and earn support for Malaysia in the United States. And at the time, he had no knowledge 1MDB was the victim of theft. The president's visit turned out to be a major disappointment. If Obama's Malaysia trip hadn't worked out as planned, Lowe could take comfort in another development. In recent weeks, he had started to date one of the world's most striking women. Chapter 37. Size Matters. New York, January 2014. The new Wanzhou restaurant on 32nd Street in Manhattan's Koreatown sat under the shadow of the Empire State Building. It was a 24/7 establishment, with plastic menus in the windows and authentic Asian fare. Exactly the sort of place Joe Lo liked to head after a late night of partying. On this night, he was ensconced at a table with Joey McFarland and some other friends. It was cold outside. The polar vortex had sent temperatures plummeting at the turn of the new year. And the group was eating Korean barbecue and soup after a night of karaoke, when Miranda Kerr, the Australian supermodel, walked in. She had come from a formal event and was wearing a ball gown, at odds with the atmosphere in the down-to-earth eatery. With her soft brown curls, iridescent blue eyes, and trademark dimples, the 30-year-old was instantly recognizable, and her elegant attire stood out in such a simple restaurant. She had come to see a friend who was part of Lowe's group and took a seat at the table. Before long, the model was engrossed in a conversation with Lowe about her skincare line, Cora Organics. As it became clear that Lowe was a major investor, a billionaire even, with interests in EMI and the Park Lane, and ties to a Hollywood studio, Kerr peppered him with questions about how to develop Cora, the running of which she had recently taken over from her mother. As Lowe had accumulated power, and perhaps because of the built-up stress, some of his earlier charm and solicitousness had worn off, and he began to exhibit a rough edge of arrogance. At a recent gambling session in Vegas, he had told a British model called Roxy Horner that she needed to lose weight, pointing to her waist. She was offended, but Lowe had learned that because he was paying, he didn't really need to care. Kerr, though, was a different prospect, and when she mentioned her desire to expand Cora, Lowe was careful to praise her financial acumen. Kerr had grown up on the edge of the Australian outback, in a stultifying farming town called Gunnedah, but she had left that world far behind. After winning an Australian modeling competition, aged only 13, she had eventually moved to the United States, where she became a Victoria's Secret model. In 2013, she earned $7 million, making her the second-best-paid female model in the world, after Gisele Bündchen, and offers kept piling up, from H&M, Swarovski, Unilever, to promote products. But a supermodel's earnings aren't enough to launch a major business, and Kerr was interested in what Lowe had to offer. She had tired of modeling and was looking to transform herself into an entrepreneur. The next morning, she had a package of Cora products couriered over to Lowe's apartment in the Time Warner building. Back in October, Kerr had divorced actor Orlando Bloom, with whom she had a 3-year-old son, and her tumultuous personal life was constant fodder for the tabloids. Her parents back in Gunnedah gave an interview to Australian television, bemoaning how their daughter had forgotten them and needed to come home to learn how to milk cows and ride horses. In the first months of 2014, Kerr would spend a chunk of time in New York, and almost every occasion she stepped out, a paparazzo would click her image. But despite the scrutiny, she managed to conceal a blossoming and unexpected romance with Lowe. On February 2nd, the Malaysian invited her to watch Super Bowl 48 at the MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. It was her first, and she attended along with Riza Aziz and McFarland. Model Kate Upton and Katie Holmes, who were in another box, stopped by. Gossip columns noted Kerr was there to watch the Seattle Seahawks pull off the biggest upset in modern football history, defeating the Denver Broncos, but Lowe's presence went unnoticed. In the ensuing days, Lowe set about wooing her in the only way he knew how. He texted Lorraine Schwartz, telling her he wanted a necklace with a heart-shaped diamond, costing between $1 and $2 million, noting that size matters. The diamond's necklace, inscribed with MK, cost $1.3 million, and Lowe gave it to the model as a present for Valentine's Day, financing it with money washed through both the Park Lane and Coastal Energy deals. Even to close friends, Lowe would say he was only helping Miranda out, And to keep the relationship secret, the pair would go out accompanied by Kerr's agent, Crystal Fox. A few weeks later, however, at a party for Kerr's 31st birthday, it would have been difficult to overlook Lowe's romantic intentions. Lowe hired out a venue on Chelsea Piers in New York for a 90s-themed party, and flew in Salt-N-Pepa, Mark Morrison, and Vanilla Ice to perform. As usual, Jamie Foxx was on hand to MC, and DiCaprio, Bloom, and Swizz Beatz were among the 100 or so invitees. For the weekend of festivities, Lowe had the Topaz, Sheikh Mansour's yacht, moored in the Hudson River, and bedecked with customized Miami-style glamour lighting and hundreds of balloons. After the partying, a helicopter flew Lowe, Kerr, and her Australian friends to Atlantic City for more gambling at the baccarat tables. It was like the old times, back during Lowe's Wharton days, although now he traveled by helicopter, not limousine, and he no longer cared whether Ivanka Trump would accept his invitation. As he was wooing Kerr, Lowe also had to keep Rosma Mansour sated. And in January 2014, he texted Lorraine Schwartz to see if she was in Los Angeles. The jeweler was in town and made haste to the Hotel Bel Air, laden with luminescent diamond bangles and necklaces. Schwartz drove into the hotel, an exclusive Spanish mission-style retreat favored by Hollywood stars, set in 12 acres of gardens in the heart of Beverly Hills. Rosma had checked into a plush suite with deep carpets, and after dinner with Schwartz and Lowe, she invited them up. Schwartz unfurled her wares onto a table, and Rosma began to pick out items. She pointed at one 18-carat white gold diamond-studded bangle, and Schwartz set it aside. It cost $52,000, but Rosma was only getting started. With the ease of a professional shopper, the first lady quickly picked out 27 bracelets and necklaces. No one talks money in these elite circles, and it took a few months for the bill to arrive at BlackRock, Lowe's company. The total was $1.3 million. Quite a moderate spending spree by Rosma's standards. Lowe took care of the invoice, and he also picked up the $300,000 tab that Rosma ran up at the Bel Air Hotel during her week's stay. Between April 2013 and September 2014, Lowe used the BlackRock account to purchase $200 million in jewelry from across the globe. Las Vegas, New York, Hong Kong, Dubai. Even more portable than art, diamonds are extremely hard to track. The Financial Action Task Force, in a 2013 report, warned that money launderers and terrorists used the diamond industry as a conduit for illicit cash. In the United States, retailers like Lorraine Schwartz, or dealers in raw and cut stones, were under no legal obligation to conduct due diligence on clients. Even better, jewels could be transported without having to send money through financial institutions. Not all the jewelry went to important figures like Rosma. On one occasion, Lowe was in Las Vegas when he found out it was the birthday of a young Asian-Canadian model, a hanger-on in his group. On the way to dinner, Lowe spontaneously ducked into a Cartier store and came back out with a watch, passing it to her without any fanfare as a last-minute gift. The watch cost $80,000. But it was Rosma on whom Lowe showered the biggest diamonds. Imelda Marcos had her shoe collection, at least 1,220 pairs left behind when she and her husband were driven out of the Philippines in 1986 by the People Power Revolution. Rosma would be known for her Birkin bags and jewelry. Hundreds of millions of dollars of rings, necklaces, and pendants, arranged in specially made drawers at her residence in Kuala Lumpur. From the outside, Lowe appeared to be accumulating prestige, and he no longer had to situate himself between formidable people, the ones who knew the secrets of how the world really works. He had become one of them in his own right. Dating a supermodel, he was pursuing deals and drawing the Malaysian prime minister and his wife ever closer. Those who hung around him, at the Super Bowl or over a dinner, still gossiped about his money. It was vaguely known he had links to Malaysia's prime minister, and it was taken as normal that such a relationship in a faraway Asian country could entail riches. Anyone who was paying close attention, however, might have noticed an extra degree of restlessness amid Lo's frenzied, globe-trotting schedule. As he whipped out his phone, excusing himself from a dinner or party, only he could see the obstacles that were piling up in his inbox, threatening to upend his scheme. Chapter 38. Losing Control. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, March 2014. The 1MDB Board of Directors started their afternoon meeting with a recitation of the first seven verses from the Quran, known as the Al-Fatiha, for the crew and passengers of MH370, the Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777-200 jet that had gone missing in early March over the South China Sea. The plane, with 239 crew and passengers on board, was flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. But just an hour after takeoff, the pilot stopped making contact with air traffic control, and moments later, the plane disappeared from civil aviation radar screens. In the weeks since, Beijing's official media had slammed Malaysia for leading a chaotic search effort, first focusing efforts on the South China Sea, north of Malaysia, before military radar showed the aircraft had gone missing over the Andaman Sea, to the west of the country. Failure to locate the plane debris added to chaotic daily briefings, spotlighted the incompetence of Malaysia's government, and was an embarrassment for Najib. The board of directors intoned the Islamic verses, but talk soon turned to another pressing matter at hand. Tan Teng Hui, the managing partner in Malaysia for Deloitte Touche, had been invited to speak, and he brought some distressing news. Only weeks earlier, Deloitte had become 1MDB's third auditor, and the fund's management was exerting huge pressure for a quick sign-off on the accounts for the year to March 31st, 2013, which had been delayed by months. Just as Deloitte was poring over the accounts, though, the firm's Southeast Asia regional headquarters in Singapore began to receive numerous emails and letters alleging financial reporting fraud at 1MDB. The complaints, Tan said, had touched on a number of issues, from 1MDB's claims to have $2.3 billion invested in an unknown fund in the Cayman Islands, to its overpayment for power plants, and a mismatch between its huge debt and minimal assets. An accountant with 30 years' experience, Tan appeared very keen to get rid of the problem. These allegations are not new, and no evidence had been provided to Deloitte to substantiate these allegations. Deloitte was therefore unable to pursue the matter, he told the board. One of the letters came from Tony Pua, a 41-year-old opposition politician who quietly had been following the 1MDB issue for a few years. Unlike many politicians, Pua had a deep grasp of business. In a previous life, he founded a technology company, before selling out to enter politics in 2008, winning a parliamentary seat the following year in a satellite town of Kuala Lumpur. Whip smart, with a degree in philosophy, politics, and economics from Oxford University, Pua unsettled time-serving UMNO politicians, who were not used to his piercing questions and mastery of financial concepts. Unable to suffer fools, Pua, an ethnic Chinese Malaysian with spiky, graying hair and a quick-fire delivery, was universally disliked in the ruling party. He became intrigued by 1MDB in 2010, when KPMG had written an emphasis of matter about the fund's investment in Petro Saudi. Such arcane terms meant nothing to most folks, but Pua knew it signaled the accountants had concerns about 1MDB. He sat on the Public Accounts Committee of the Parliament, which was charged with overseeing state spending, and so agitated for the committee to investigate. But the chairman, an UMNO politician, had dragged his heels. By 2014, though, with articles in The Edge pointing out the fishy Cayman Islands Fund investment, Pua had more firepower. 1MDB fired KPMG in January, after the auditing firm had been unable to confirm the $2.3 billion the Malaysian fund claimed to have in the Cayman Islands was really worth that much, or whether it actually existed. Back in 2012, the 1MDB fund had sold its interest in a Petro-Saudi subsidiary that owned the two oil drill ships to a company controlled by Hong Kong financier Lobo Lee. Instead of cash, 1MDB had received payment of $2.3 billion in the form of units in a newly formed Cayman Islands fund. It was a fictional transaction, aimed at covering up the money that Lowe and others had taken from 1MDB in 2009. Yeo-Ja Wei of BSI had misled KPMG that the Cayman Islands investment was backed by cash, not just shady units. But the transaction just didn't seem right to the U.S. auditing firm. Refusing to sign off on the accounts, KPMG was dumped, just as 1MDB had fired Ernst & Young before it. Eager to build its business in Malaysia, Deloitte signed on. KPMG's removal was a roadblock for Lowe, who needed an auditor to quickly rubber stamp 1MDB's accounts. With $10 billion in debt and only $20 million in cash, the fund was in dire straits, hemorrhaging tens of millions of dollars a month. But Lowe had a game plan. The 1MDB energy unit was planning to list its shares on Malaysia's stock exchange. Hopefully, big global institutional investors would snap up the shares, given Asia's economic outlook was still brighter than the West's, and the IPO would net $5 billion or more. It was an optimistic assessment, but one that was crucial to keeping the scheme going, providing Lowe with the money he desperately needed to hide the fund's losses. Major banks, including Goldman Sachs and Deutsche, were feeding the optimism, telling 1MDB there would be ample appetite from global investors, keen themselves to win a mandate to advise on the IPO. Even an amount lower than $5 billion would be enough to fill financial holes and stop the scrutiny of 1MDB, Lowe anticipated. But first, Deloitte needed to okay the delayed accounts. Like KPMG, Deloitte's TAN had issues with the accounting of the Cayman Islands investment. To get around the problem, Lowe turned again to Mohammed al-Husseini, asking for Abar to guarantee the offshore money. This meant that the Abu Dhabi fund would cover the amount no matter what. It should have been a red flag for Deloitte, given the letters it had received alleging financial fraud at 1MDB, not to mention the fact that 1MDB already had ended its relationship with two major auditors. But a piece of paper from Abar appeared to be good enough for TAN to get comfortable with the investment. Auditors are meant to be independent, but TAN offered for Deloitte to help 1MDB with its media relations. With barely any business and encumbered by huge borrowings, the only way for 1MDB to avoid a financial loss was to again revalue its land portfolio and book the profits, as it had done in 2010. In this way, 1MDB was hoping to show a $260 million profit. TAN was not only supportive of this accounting, he also offered to explain it publicly to help deflect any negative media stories. Deloitte had been so helpful, in fact, that TAN asked whether his firm would be selected to audit 1MDB's many subsidiaries, including the energy unit that was gearing up for an IPO. The board confirmed TAN's request immediately, and its chairman, Lodin Kamarudin, Najib's close aide, said he wanted Deloitte's professionalism and objectivity put on record. Still, the board was adamant that 1MDB's management repatriate the Cayman Islands money to help slash the fund's debt and to show the Edge newspaper and other critics they were wrong. Only Lowe and perhaps a few associates like al-Husseini and Yeo knew the truth. There was no money in the Cayman Islands. As dawn approached one night in May, Lowe made an unusual request of staff in a private gaming room at the Palazzo on the Las Vegas Strip. Drunk and in his element, Lowe called out for a watermelon. Some of those crowding around the baccarat table, many of them models, didn't know this short, pudgy figure who was putting down $200,000 bets at a time. The whisper went around that he'd financed The Wolf of Wall Street, a film that everyone was talking about, but there was something unhinged about him. He was on a losing streak, and when the palazzo staff turned up with a watermelon from the kitchens, Lo seized it and rolled it down the table, supposedly for good luck, sending cards flying. Still, the losses mounted, and guzzling Johnny Walker Blue Label whiskey, he started bellowing to staff again. "Red t-shirts," he told a staff member waiting on.